The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we are especially excited to welcome to the podcast today, Omer Bartov. Omer is Dean's Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. He is the author of many books. One of the first books I read in graduate school was his book, Hitler's Army, about the Wehrmacht and this primary group connections that they had. But most recently, he is the author of Israel, What Went Wrong, and we invited him to talk about that book. So, Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I think we should just start where the book does, which is your own personal connections to Israel, how, in your view, the state was formed, how it changed over time. And answering this question, you know, what went wrong implies that something could have gone right. And I think this is, as we just talked briefly off mic, a question that many Jews of my generation, particularly in the so-called diaspora, are asking is, was this project necessarily doomed? Was liberal Zionism impossible from the beginning? Or could there have been another path? So there's a lot there, but why don't we start with your personal history?
So I was born in Israel in the mid-1950s. I was born in a kibbutz. I was raised in Tel Aviv. I, you know, went to school in Israel. I served for 4 years in the IDF, a period that overlapped with the war of 1973. I ended my service as infantry company commander. Then I studied in Israel. I did a first degree at Tel Aviv University, DPhil at Oxford University, taught several years at Tel Aviv University, which included the beginning of the first Intifada. And then in 1989, I moved to the U.S. and started teaching here. I have always kept in close touch with Israel. My parents live there. They're now buried in the kibbutz of my birth. I have a son who lives in Israel. I have 2 grandkids there and I have many friends there. And over the years, I spent significant periods in Israel and have many friends there, many connections there, also many colleagues there. So that's in terms of my own personal history. My departure from Israel in 1989 partly was academic. I just had a fellowship at Harvard that was very hard to turn down. And after that, I just stayed and taught at Rutgers University and then at Brown since 2000. But it also had to do with growing discomfort with what was happening in Israel and particularly the outbreak of the First Intifada. I write about that in the book. I expected to be called up as a reserve officer, and I was happy to make my way to Cambridge, Mass. Instead. As for the big question, what went wrong? Was it always wrong? You know, I have to say, once the book came out, I've received responses from both sides, of course. So some people write me Well, it was always wrong. So Zionism was a bad idea, or Zionism was a genocidal ideology from the beginning, and everything was predetermined. I obviously don't think that, and that's not what I write in the book. So I try to identify moments at which things could have gone in another direction. And I do that both because I think that's the case and because I don't really believe in kind of predetermined history. I don't think that everything that happens was inevitable. And the fact that it happened doesn't mean that other things could not have happened. So choices can always be made, I think. I also get responses from the other side who say the only thing that went wrong is me. And, you know, Batov went wrong and Israel is perfectly fine. And that to me is actually good because it means that I'm someplace in between and I don't really accept either position. So I'll explain very briefly what I think went wrong. And the whole book is about
actually,
it.
Actually, Professor, before I do want to hear that, but before we get on, I just have a question as long as I have you here. So obviously, there's always historical contingency and humans enact agency. But from a structural position, how do you address the question of ethno-nationalism? Yeah, just as a fundamental structuring ideology,
Yes, absolutely. So that's exactly what I was about to say because, Zionism begins within the context of ethno-nationalism. Zionism is born from ethno-nationalism. Zionism is born in East Central Europe, where ethno-nationalism is spreading, is exclusive, tends to be, to one degree or another, racist, and says that one ethno group, a particular ethnic group, has the right to a particular territory and it doesn't want any other ethnic group there. That's the whole idea. And so Zionism is one Jewish response to those movements, which, among other things, start thinking about Jews as not belonging to where they are. And 80% of world Jewry live there. And many of them respond to this newly invented Jewish question in other ways. The vast majority actually go to North America and become American and Canadian Jews. Others try to assimilate into their societies, and some succeed and some don't. And many others join socialism and communism because they believe that the revolution will do away with all these questions of religion and ethnicity and will all just be, the working class, free of its chains. And some, in a minority initially, say, well, why don't we also do what everybody else is doing? Let's, emulate the goyim. We'll also declare ourselves to be a nation. And Zionism is an ethno-national movement. And it takes many, if you compare it to Polish or Ukrainian nationalism, it takes many of the attributes of ethno-nationalism of those groups and declares the Jews to be also a nation. It self-determines itself as a nation. And the only problem the Jews have is that they don't have a territory. The Poles say this is Polish territory and the Ukrainians and Jews don't belong here. The Ukrainians say the Poles don't belong here. The Jews don't belong. The Poles and the Ukrainians agree on one thing. The Jews don't belong. And so they start thinking, where do we belong? And eventually they end up on, well, we'll go back to our ancestral homeland, mythical, religious, historical. We'll go back to Palestine, to Eretz Israel. Now, once Zionism starts going to Eretz Israel, lo and behold, of course, there are people living there, which was not really part of the Zionist imaginary. They weren't thinking about other people living there. But there are people there. They encounter them from the very beginning. In 1882, there are Arabs living there. And then what happens was that Zionism, in many ways, becomes very much what the other ethno-national movements that it was trying to rescue the Jews from were. That is, it finds itself as in conflict with the indigenous population on two levels. One is the way the Palestinians experience Zionism as an ethno-national movement. It comes and it settles the land. It comes from elsewhere. It colonizes it. And it's not shy about saying that. It says, we are colonizing. We are building koloniot. We're building moshavot. That's what we are doing. We're conquering labor. And the Palestinians respond, as any indigenous population does, to this encroachment. They try to resist it. The second thing that happens is that this brings about also the creation of Palestinian nationalism. And so you not only have a conflict between a settler colonial movement, but also a conflict between two ethno-national movements. One is Zionism and the other is Palestinian. So in that sense, Zionism has built into it the characteristics of an ethno-national movement. Ethno-nationalism is violent, it's exclusive, it has clearly racist potential, and it can normalize over time. So Poland today, we don't think of Poland today as a genocidal state. But Poland is actually built on ethno-nationalism. And Poland, after World War II, accomplished that. It became a state only or mostly for Poles, right? There was genocide, there was ethnic cleansing, a lot of horrible things happened. Then there was communist rule for 40 years. And finally, when that was lifted, Poland is a land for Poles. There are a few Ukrainians there, slightly more now because of the war in Russia. There are a few Jews there, slightly more now because some Jews have come back. But it's mostly Roman Catholic Poles. And it's not a genocidal state. It's part of the EU. We think it's not a bad place at all. So ethno-national movements can be very violent and have been and can become genocidal and can also then normalize in one way or another. So for me, the question is, when did Zionism change? When did... Yeah, go ahead.
I just have a question. Are there historical examples of ethno-nationalist movements not being... even not genocidal, but not contributing to ethnic cleansing? Because it seems like the dialectical relationship that's naturally established is that it's going to require some sort of expulsion at the very least, if not full-on genocide. The ones that immediately come to mind, United States, Australia, the most of the Western Hemisphere, they do seem at least... ethnic cleansing seems a necessity. Are there examples of that not happening?
Actually, the examples you give are examples of settler colonialism. The U.S. generally is not an ethno-national entity. It's the opposite. That's why...
it replaced it with whiteness, I think. I think there's something going, like with the indigenous genocide and slavery. I agree it's not pure ethno-nationalism. But in the 19th century, you could argue that Anglo-German Concordat was a sort of new world version of ethno-nationalism. And then whiteness sort of papers over things.
You could
there.
Say that. You could say that. And obviously, there has been... white supremacy in the U.S. has been a huge amount of racism in the U.S. But you also have to concede that 2.5 million Jews, for instance, came from Eastern Europe to America and became Americans and eventually came to be white.
People
like me,
it's different.
Coming from Israel and my wife coming from Hong Kong, came here and were accepted in ways that if we were to come to Germany or Britain or France, would have been much more complicated.
Yeah, so, absolutely true. Yeah.
So the U.S. and Australia are countries that actually took in different ethnic groups, but they are also settler colonial states. So they did carry out genocides of the indigenous population without having an ethno-national grounding. That's another sort of species. It's related, but it's another species. In Europe,
for sure,
there is ethno-nationalism, which is really nationalism of a particular ethnic group that is usually linked to the territory in which most members of that ethnic group lived before ethno-nationalism was invented. And it gives them this kind of, it describes them in a particular way. It makes them into a nation, which they were not before. They were just from there. And now they belong to that nation. So they're reinvented as members of a particular ethnic and the national group. Are there examples of... it depends on the context. There was less... I wouldn't say that there was ethnic cleansing in Lithuania. And Lithuania sees itself largely as an ethno-national state. There wasn't really ethnic cleansing... there was a degree of ethnic cleansing in Western Ukraine of Poles and in Eastern Poland of Ukrainians. It's the same territory. It's just seen from two sides. But there is a predilection toward that. It doesn't always end up in genocide. The case of Zionism, to me, is interesting in the sense that in the 1920s and 30s, you have Zionism exercising both its faces. It has two aspects. One is the ethno-national face. More and more Jews are coming to Palestine. They're encroaching in more and more Palestinian land that leads to more and more conflict. That's one. And it's both, as I say, it's a national conflict and it's a settler colonial conflict. And all this under the aegis of the British Empire that facilitates all of this. There's a second aspect of Zionism at the same time that Jews are being increasingly persecuted in Europe and have fewer and fewer places to go to. The U.S. closes its gates off in the early 1920s. Other European countries, certainly after the Great Depression, don't want foreigners, certainly not Ostjuden. And so from the point of view of Jews, those hundreds of thousands of Jews who come to Palestine, as Zionism would claim, were saved. That includes members of my family. Had my grandfathers not decided to leave Poland in the 1920s and 30s, as did most of their extended families, I would not have been born, not in Eastern Europe and not in Palestine, because everybody who stayed there was murdered. So Zionism has this claim that it also served as a safe haven for Jews, which was what it said it would do. And so to me, the moment at which these two faces of genocide become one and become the aggressive, militant, intolerant, and increasingly racist one is 1948. In 1948, the state is created. It is a Jewish majority state, and it becomes that through ethnic cleansing, right? Because the masses of Jews that were expected to come from Eastern Europe are dead. They can't come anymore. So how do you create a Jewish majority state in a territory where two-thirds of the population are Palestinian and only a third are Jews? Well, you do it as Zionism does in 1948 through ethnic cleansing. You remove them from what becomes the state of Israel. And then you have a choice. Now you've created what Zionism wanted, a Jewish majority state. 80% of the population are Jews, only 20% are Palestinian. And so to me, that's a moment at which one could have, and there were debates over that. I'm not just imagining this. One could have asked oneself, what sort of state do we want? How do we move forward from here? And the Zionist movement, headed by Ben-Gurion, issues a declaration, a proclamation of the state, in which it promises that it would be a state where all citizens would be equal. Now, he does that under pressure of the UN, of course. They weren't happy about doing it, but they did it anyway. And they promise to issue a constitution within a few months. The proclamation is on May 14th, 1948. They say by October 1st, there will be a constitution that would be in the spirit of the proclamation that includes this Bill of Rights. And that is never issued. And so it's at that point that the state, having not formed for itself a legal framework and having not declared what its borders are, it didn't then and it still hasn't done so, makes Zionism into a state ideology. There is a state and there is an ideology. And despite the fact that the ideology accomplished what it wanted to accomplish and could now be consigned to the archive, it actually becomes the ideology of the state. And as such, once that ideology has a state, has an army, has a police, has all the structure of a state, it can now exercise the more radical elements of ethno-nationalism, which it does over time.
It's very interesting. I mean, to me, that seems quite overdetermined. If the wrong turn is in the literal, basically founding of the state, and I mean the historical contingency of the Holocaust, obviously, and this world Jewry, and maybe if there's no Holocaust, maybe the Jewish question would have also been answered differently. I mean, the Holocaust wipes out basically socialist Jews in to a large degree. These various alternatives, and one could appreciate why in the late 1940s ethno-nationalism did not appear like a radical or an unnecessary decision, but it does seem kind of baked in if the initial wrong turn is in the literal founding of the state, which I think raises questions about particularly Jews in the diaspora relationship to Israel going forward. But Derek, I know you had a question. Sorry, Omer, if you want to respond.
No, just to say, I do not claim that as a 48, everything that happened was predetermined. Quite on the contrary.
It's not predetermined. I don't mean to suggest that. I just that's unsophisticated. I don't mean to suggest that.
No.
But again, there's paths. You know, men make their own history.
Yes.
The gender, yeah, et cetera. Yeah. But yeah, I just wanted to make that clear, but please.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, it was not predetermined, but a particular framework for that was created. I think that a constitution would have made possible, or put it otherwise, would have made it impossible, potentially, for Israel to impose 20 years of military rule over the Palestinians who remained in the country and to use those 20 years to take away most of their lands. It might have created a legal framework that would have made it possible or necessary to some extent come to terms with the Nakba, with the expulsion, and to have some process of partial repatriation, partial restitution, to actually face up to the issues that were created by the creation of the state in the way it was created. Not having it meant that the core issue of the state of Israel from 48 to today, and that I would maintain, the core issue is that it has never come to terms with the fact that it is a country that was born from massive expulsion of the indigenous population, and that then in 1967 took over many of the same people it had expelled, but has kept them in a one-state situation under different regimes. That is, that Israel is a country that was a Jewish-majority state for only 20 years, and after that became a 50-50 state in which half of the population live under different types of regimes. That is at the core issue of Israeli existence, and it's something that most Israelis over time have learned how to effectively ignore.
So I want to ask you about the various ways of reckoning with the Holocaust. You have an entire chapter in the book devoted to the question of never again, and what does that actually mean? And, you know, this runs the gamut, of course, from the hyper-specific, like, you know, never again will an Austrian dictator massacre the Jews of Germany and Eastern Europe in 1940, or in the 1940s, to the universal, which is, you know, never again will we allow genocide to happen. And obviously the international community has failed repeatedly in that regard. But as you say in the book, the architecture has been put in place to treat that question as a universal question. We've got the International Criminal Court. We've had tribunals and other cases modeled on, you know, some of the things that were done at Nuremberg. Like there is an effort, at least by the international community, to universalize this, to never again will there be a genocide. And then somewhere in between is this never again will anything like this happen to the Jewish people. And if it takes displacing a population in Palestine, ethnically cleansing them, committing even genocide in Gaza, then so be it. But never again will this happen to Jews. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how these questions have been kind of batted around and sort of how people have come to these positions.
Yeah. So again, it's a large issue. Of course, there were people right after World War II who, including quite a number of prominent Holocaust survivors, who spoke about never again, not never again, what happened to them, the Holocaust itself, because by then it was over, but never again such inhumanity. The whole concept of genocide, the whole concept of legislating against crimes against humanity, against genocide, was based not on never again having the Holocaust, but never again having similar mass crimes against innocent civilians or groups. We have to remember that the Holocaust itself was not a big player in any of this. And we tend to think of the Holocaust as always being on people's minds. Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide, had the Holocaust on his mind because his family was murdered in the Holocaust. So obviously, there were people who had it on their minds. But the Holocaust recedes in collective memory everywhere. for another 40 years, and it starts re-emerging in the 1980s and 90s. So this notion of an international regime, a legal regime created to prevent genocide and mass crimes, is first of all not necessarily about the Holocaust. Secondly, it doesn't really kick in very well during those first 40 years for another reason, and that's the Cold War. So you can't really have, international tribunals if there's a Cold War and the world is divided into this bipolar division. But in Israel, there is a particular process, and that process has Israeli peculiarities, and it's more, I think it informs our understanding of why Israel behaves the way it does better when we focus on that. In the early years after the Holocaust, in Israel, as I write in the book, there is a sense of discomfort with the Holocaust. There's actually a sense of discomfort also with Holocaust survivors specifically, because they're foreign, they look funny, they behave in strange ways, they wear jackets, they cover their tattooed forearms with long sleeves on the beach. There's all of this, which I also remember. But in the educational system, there's hardly any teaching of the Holocaust. It's just not there. And there's a reason for it, because there's a sense of shame about the Holocaust. When we studied about the Holocaust, which was not much when I was in school in Israel, it was mostly the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. We studied the Holocaust because it taught us that you have to resist violence. But most of the Jews, as we internalized it growing up in Israel, went like sheep to the slaughter. And that's not a very good lesson for Zionism. It's the opposite of what we wanted. We were supposed to look forward and to be militant and strong and have hairy legs and be tanned and know how to fight and not go like sheep to the slaughter. That starts changing, I would say, with the Eichmann trial, and I have memories of listening to that. But the main change is much later. The main change is after 67, even more so after the war of 1973, and radically when Menachem Begin comes to power, when the right wing comes to power, under Menachem Begin specifically, because he had memories of Poland and of the Holocaust. And he starts speaking, this is 1977, and he starts making all these analogies to the Holocaust. There's the famous saying by him in 1982 that Arafat in Beirut, following the Israeli invasion there, of course, that attempt of regime change, not the current one, that Arafat hiding in Beirut is like Hitler in his bunker. These kind of analogies become increasingly ubiquitous in Israel. And it's at that point, and, my former professor, Yudael Kana, who was a professor of history when I was an undergrad, wrote an article in 1988 with the outbreak of the First Intifada called In Praise of Forgetting. And what he wrote there was that this education by then of young Israeli men and women, that the Holocaust was a major part of their identity and that it was not only something to remember, but something to fear happening again. That is a process that he identified already early on and became increasingly ubiquitous in Israel, that the Holocaust is not something that we should commemorate and remember and write about. It is an imminent danger. It's about to happen to us. And the curious thing about this mechanism is that this kicks in precisely at a time when Israel no longer is facing an existential danger. The last major war that Israel fought, a real war, was the war that I was in. It was the war of 1973 when I was 20. All the other wars that Israel fought since were wars of choice against insurgents, militants, who largely were the products of Israeli policies, whether it's Hamas or it's Hezbollah. These were all created by Israeli policies. They were responses to Israel. But neither of them or any other country presented an existential threat to the IDF. The IDF became the hegemon militarily in its own region. And secondly, the Holocaust comes to play a major role at a time when fewer and fewer people have actual memories of it, because most of those people died. And so it becomes something else. It becomes a license. It gives Israel a carte blanche. It can do what it likes. And to whom? To those that it rules and oppresses. those who cannot physically, materially, militarily, cannot present an existential threat to it. They are those that it rules over. And they are those who are presented as the people who must somehow be kept under the boot, because if we let them go, they will destroy the state of Israel. And of course, that kicks in with a particular bloody-minded energy after October 7th, when they do break out, and then all the demons are set loose.
So a couple of questions. It's very interesting. Something similar is happening to the United States at the exact same time. I mean, with the new justification, I think a new justification for empire in the post-Cold War world, obviously very different from Israel. But basically between 89 and 90, 2001 and September 11th, human rights, responsibility to protect, that becomes a justifying logic for empire. So you have basically human rights being used in this perverse way. Even if in the American case, at least, there were some, you know, one could argue it's just causes embedded there. So just as an analytical matter, why do you think that this historical memory became embedded in this particular way between the Likud ascension in 77 and October 7th? Why? Was there, again, if it wasn't overdetermined, what are the particular structures and personalities that lead this to become the logic of Israeli empire?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the two reasons for this, I think. One reason is that the weeks leading to the war of 1967, and I remember that very well. I was a teenager in London at the time, and which were a moment of enormous fear, you know, with Gamal Abdel Nasser saying that, you know, the Jews would be thrown to the sea and all of that. And had a huge impact not only in Israel, but also Jewish communities around the world, in France, in the UK, in the US. That was the beginning for large Jewish communities to start thinking, oh, we really need that state of Israel. Because there was a sense that it might be destroyed. There might be extinction. And then the war of 1973, which was experienced by me too, as an existential war. Now, it actually wasn't, and it was preventable, so you can, but it was experienced as such, with Moshe Dayan saying, this is going to be the fall of the Third Temple. The same Moshe Dayan who said, better having Sharm el-Sheikh without peace than peace without Sharm el-Sheikh, 2 years later says, this is the end of the Third Temple. I think the sense that the whole thing might just disappear plays into it. And, you know, people don't think about it, but among soldiers in 1973, there were reservists who had been children in the Holocaust, who actually had memories of the Holocaust. There was still a personal connection. So I think that these two wars that both end up with Israeli hegemony, military hegemony, but are experienced also as moments of existential threat play into the reemergence of the Holocaust. That's, I think, an important element in that. The second thing is the occupation. The occupation is, as a phenomenon, if you actually try to think about the fact that in 1967, when the occupation begins, I was 13 years old. I'm now 72. So that's the almost the entire length of the state of Israel. It's been a state that oppresses vast numbers of people who don't want to be ruled by it. How do you rationalize that? How do you keep an idea of yourself as being just and right while you are actually creating an apartheid system? How do you do that? Even in South Africa, there were arguments that, well, we don't have a choice. That's the only way that we can somehow survive as a white group bossing it over millions of Africans, of black Africans. I think the Holocaust plays a legitimizing role in what is clearly illegitimate, illegal, immoral, unethical, unacceptable, according to any understanding, including of Judaism itself. And to say that we have to do it, because if we don't, This represents an existential danger to us, alleviates the responsibility of just facing the truth and saying this situation has to be changed. And you can see that the use of the Holocaust as a tool to justify the occupation increases as the attempts to respond to the occupation disappear. There's much more use of it after Rabin is assassinated, after the Oslo Accords are in tatters, and now it's ubiquitous. So in that sense, it justifies the unjustifiable.
So I got a couple of quick questions. I mean, you're so steeped in German history. This reminds me a little bit of the old functionalist versus intentionalist debates. Is this an argument about no 67, no 73? Israel is very different.
Look, I mean, that's a little bit of, you know, counterfactual history, but 67 is the great Pyrrhic victory of Israel, definitely. Because, as I said, Zionism accomplished its goal in 48. It created the Jewish majority state. Okay, it first of all kicked out vast numbers of Palestinians, then it mistreated the Palestinians that stayed there. You could say Israel was a democracy only for 6 months between December 1966, when the military rule over the Palestinian citizens of Israel was lifted, and 1967, when then all these hundreds of thousands of formerly expelled Palestinians come under Israeli rule. But at least it was a Jewish majority state. That is, it could argue that it was on the way to creating a Jewish and democratic state. After 67, that was not possible, and many people talked about it. There were years in the immediate aftermath of 1967 when people said, well, if we want to keep Israel Jewish and democratic, we have to use these occupied territories as bargaining chips. We have to resolve the major issue. And that was not done. And then that was not only not done, but the whole idea of even talking about it or even saying the word occupation, which has disappeared from Israel. People never use occupation anymore. It's only sort of left-wing, radical left-wingers who say occupation. It's gone. And with that, yes, with that, of course, the main notion that it could be a democratic state disappeared. It became, at best, second priority. So I would say, without 67, it would have been a different state. I would agree with that. But was it possible not to have 67? We have to remember.
Right, that's the other question.
Before
which is
that,
like,
there was 56.
Yeah. Right.
In 56,
right.
Israel, you know, took over Gaza. And there were discussions in 56, how do we kick out the Palestinians from Gaza?
Right. This is that's the ultimate question is like, was this an inevitability? But that's worthy of more than a conversation. Derek, did you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about another chapter in your book about the missing constitution. This is an interesting element of this that I had never really considered before. But, you know, basically in terms of enshrining the ideals of Israel's Declaration of Independence into a document that would set out the parameters of the state, that would say this is going to be a democracy, or this is going to be, you know, how is this going to be structured? What are the borders going to be? Like, none of this stuff, and Israel now functions on basic law, series of basic laws, rather than an enshrined constitution. And it creates a situation where, you know, you can change these things, seemingly fundamental things about the state relatively easily. So can you talk a little bit about why, even though it was envisioned, I think, in the partition agreement, like in the very basic kind of understanding of the creation of the state of Israel, that there would be a constitution, why this never actually materialized, and what that means in terms of the contemporary state?
Yeah, so the first thing is that Israel issues this proclamation of a state, which is known in Israel as a Declaration of Independence, although it's not clear independence from whom, because the British were leaving that very midnight, on the midnight of May 14th, 1948. It issues that in part because it has to do that. The UN partition resolution demands that the two states, that were supposed to be an Arab state and a Jewish state, would issue a declaration that would be followed by a constitution that would provide for a democracy and for a Bill of Rights. And Israel wants to become a member of the UN. It's the most important political move in the creation of a state for Israel to be recognized by the UN. And so the process of articulating the declaration, the proclamation of the state, is in large part informed by the demands that you can find. If you read the partition resolution, all the demands are there. You have to say that there would be equality for all citizens, all races, all religions, and so forth. And there are debates over that. So, for instance, the proclamation does not use the word democracy. It's not there. It says a Jewish state. It doesn't actually say democratic state. But it's implied within the declaration. That declaration, which gives both a historical background for why a state should be created and then defines what the state would be, but does not define its borders, because Ben-Gurion opposed defining the borders in the proclamation and said, let's see, we don't know. There's going to be a war. Let's see what kind of borders we'll have. So he does not accept the partition borders, or at least he doesn't say so specifically. That was supposed to be enshrined in the constitution. Now, why was there no constitution? A constitution would have had to have all these elements that were in the proclamation. The proclamation ends up having no legal, or at least I would say disputable legal value. The Supreme Court at the time decided not to give the proclamation legal standing because it expected the constitution. But there was no constitution. Why was there no constitution? Well, the simple answer is that Ben-Gurion was opposed to it. And Ben-Gurion really, what he said went. And the reason that he opposed it is said to be mostly because of the ultra-religious. Because the ultra-religious said, we don't need a constitution. We have the Torah. Who needs a constitution? That's a sort of goyish concept. But the fact of the matter is that the Orthodox were not a major element in decision-making and policies at the time. So they were used in large part as an excuse. What is between the lines is that if a constitution included these elements that were in the proclamation, that would have given equal rights constitutionally to the Palestinians. And that the state was not willing to do. And again, that means that the issue that is not, and a lot of legal experts in Israel, and I was reading all these debates, avoid this issue. They don't want to talk about it. They say, yes, it's the religious elements. The core issue is the relationship between Jews and Palestinians, which is the relationship between being a Jewish state and a democratic state. That's at the core of it. So not having a constitution did what Israeli politics is excellent at doing. It postponed it. It left it to some indefinite future, and it created the mechanism, an alternative mechanism, that there would be constitutional laws that would eventually be put together as a constitution. And if you want to understand why there was and is an ongoing judicial coup, so-called overhaul in Israel now, it is an attempt to overturn the constitutional laws of the early 1990s, the same early 1990s which also saw the last real effort to change the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, right? To create some kind of alternative. It wasn't a great alternative. There are a lot of issues with Oslo, but it was an attempt at least to recognize the issue of the occupation and provide some kind of remedy to that. The same time, these two constitutional laws of 1992 try to create, to recreate, to reinvent Israel as a state with a constitution and with a Bill of Rights. It's, again, it's partial. That, of course, is overturned in part already in 2018, because you can pass any constitutional law that you like if you have a majority in parliament and declare that law to be constitutional. In 2018, Israel passes a constitutional law that flies in the face of the previous laws. that is that Israel is the nation state of the Jews. It relegates Israeli Palestinian citizens to second-class citizenship. And it declares that Israel is Eretz Israel, that Israel has a right to settle all of the land of Israel, meaning not only the state that is recognized internationally within the 67 borders, but also the occupied territories. That's what the Basic Law does. But that's insufficient for the people who are now in power in Israel, and that's why they're trying to change the entire structure. Now, the last thing I will say is, and I read about it in this chapter, and was very interesting for me to figure out, and I was using, I have to say, I was using a lot of what Michael's father has written. He has a book in Hebrew, which I hope will come out in English, that explains a lot of this. He's a civil rights lawyer in Israel. We think of the Supreme Court in Israel as the protector of rights in Israel, and it's highly beleaguered by the right. And it's true that it tried to protect the rights of Israeli citizens, of secular, of Ashkenazi, of Tel Aviv-dwelling Israeli citizens, to protect gay rights and so forth. But it is the Supreme Court that actually created the legal mechanism that facilitated the entire settlement project in Israel. It created the legal fiction for Israeli citizens who are living exterritorially in the occupied territories to be ruled by Israeli law, while Palestinians living there are under military law. That is, it actually facilitated the creation of an apartheid system in the West Bank, that very same Supreme Court, under Aaron Barak, the most liberal of all the justices, the man who led the revolution, the constitutional revolution of the early 1990s, and then claimed that Israel had a constitution. That same court. Now, had there been a constitution, it is possible that none of this would have been possible because the Supreme Court could not have twisted legal reality in that way. It would have been constrained. And so again, we don't know whether that would have happened and Israel could have always chucked away its constitution, created a different constitution, but it would have created some framework, and that framework was missing even for the Supreme Court itself.
One question I had was, you've spent the last 37 years or so in the diaspora in the United States, and I'm just curious your thoughts on diasporic Jews, and particularly liberal Zionism as expressed in this country, which was the predominant mode of Zionism, and how you're seeing that transform or not transform. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion within the Jewish community about generational divides and what is the future of U.S.-Israeli policy when both political parties seem to at least have factions that are very critical of it. I think that ironically in the Democratic Party, I think they're going to turn hard away from Israel. I'm not sure if Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene have as much influence in the Republican side, remains to be seen. But there's a lot obviously going on with the diasporic Jewry, and I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, I had a couple of discussions with Gideon Levy, the journalist from Haaretz, who has proclaimed himself now to be anti-Zionist and has said that, has criticized me for being, not saying that I'm anti-Zionist. And I'm saying that because there is now, and I meet, you know, my own students, people say that they're anti-Zionist. And that is one response to what people perceive to be liberal Zionism while supporting Israel, where Zionism is anything but liberal and simply cannot be defined as liberal. So first I'll say something about anti-Zionism. I generally don't like ideologies that are anti, whatever anti they are, because it's not an attempt to think about something positively, to create something, it's to negate something. That's a strange way of starting off an ideology. But I also think that if you think of Zionism as one assertion, which is that Jews have a right of self-determination, then you have to decide, are you in favor of that or not? I think that nationalism is a terrible idea, and ethno-nationalism is even worse. and has led to vast amounts of bloodshed and suffering. That's a given. But if you support self-determination for one group, then you have to be consistent. If you're against self-determination for Jews, I don't see any reason why you would be in favor of self-determination for Palestinians or for anybody else. Either you're for that or you're against that. I'm not against that. I think it's a bad idea. I would rather nationalism disappeared, but we live in states. We know that the alternative is worse because being stateless is a really bad idea, as the Jews learned themselves, as Hannah Arendt already outlined. And so to be a purist and to say, well, I'm against that, so what are you in favor of? That's one question. And in this, my position on Zionism is not that the Jews did not have a right of self-determination. They had the same right as the Poles and the Ukrainians for that. What you don't have is a right to exercise it by oppressing and killing other people. If you do that, you may actually lose that right. If that's the way you exercise it over time, if that's your only understanding of what it is. So the Zionism that exists now in Israel, that Zionism has discredited Zionism as an ideology entirely. So I don't think that anyone today can be a Zionist without being affiliated in one way or another with Jewish supremacy, which is what Zionism in Israel is today. It's a genocidal, racist, Jewish supremacist ideology. That ideology has to be discarded. And I don't believe that you can be a liberal Zionist in New York or in LA as if what Zionism in Israel is doing is not happening. So you have to find an alternative. And as you know, Zionism in America from the 1970s became a matter of identity. It wasn't that people were Zionists in the sense that Zionism meant it, meaning that they would go to Israel. Most of them didn't go. They were Zionists. It was part of their identity. They didn't think too much about it. They went to Sunday school and got nice descriptions of Israel. They went on these trips to Israel and met nice...
They bought a billion trees for Israel. Israel's covered 14 times in trees for all the trees that Americans bought.
Yes, or they found a nice husband or wife among handsome young Israelis and then took them back with them to LA or to New York. But it wasn't really thought through as an ideology in the way that Zionism was at the beginning and in the way that it implemented Zionism in Palestine and then in the state of Israel. I think that now American Jewry is facing two major crises. One crisis is its relationship to Israel. That's a major crisis. And my sense is that it would be impossible if Israel continues on this trajectory, if it doesn't redefine itself, which it could do, but it's not very likely these days. As you say, if there's a different political leadership in the United States that redefines the limits of Israeli power, then it's possible. But that's in the long run. I don't think that most Jews in the United States will be able to associate themselves with the state of Israel the way it is today and in the direction that it is going, because it will be a danger to their own safety. It is already a major trigger to anti-Semitism around the world. And in that sense, I think there will be a growing sort of shift away from it. But there's another element, and that's religion. In Israel, Judaism has reinvented itself. It has become something that is more akin to the zealots of Roman times than to anything that any Jew living out of Israel can adopt. You cannot be a Jewish supremacist in New York or in LA. That's shooting yourself in the foot. You are a minority in all those countries. You're only a majority, although not even in Israel, you're actually a majority. But at least you have a monopoly of power in Israel. You do not have it elsewhere. So the kind of Judaism that exists now in Israel, which is a perversion of Judaism that we have not seen for two millennia, cannot be the same Judaism that people would have in the diaspora. And that will call for a major shift in people's understanding of what they are, not only in relationship to Israel, but their relationship to their own faith and tradition.
So you're not in favor of the Third Temple? Just kidding.
It fell in 1973.
Yeah, no 73, no Third Temple. But thank you so much, Professor. We really appreciated you having you on. Everyone, check out Israel, What Went Wrong, and Professor Bartov's many other books on a wide variety of subjects, particularly related to military history and the history of genocide. Love to have you back on again soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.